Hi, I'm Jane Lindholm. I'm the host of Vermont Edition, and I just wanted to let you know that this podcast has been edited for brevity. Thanks for listening.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Bob Kinzel. One result of the coronavirus pandemic has been the critical need to expand high-speed internet access in every part of Vermont. How can people be expected to work at home, take advantage of telemedicine opportunities, or participate in online higher education or K-12 education programs without these essential services? And how likely is it that Congress will finally address this issue in an upcoming massive infrastructure package? That's one of the questions we have for our guest today, Congressman Peter Welch. Congressman, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
And many thanks for taking the time to be with us today. We know you've got a busy schedule. The new normalcy is difficult on everyone, and you're taking the time to listen to some questions from VPR listeners is greatly appreciated. Congressman, you know, Vermont was one of the last states in the country to have electrical services in all rural parts of the state. I think that was in the early 1950s. I mean, electricity has long been considered an absolutely essential service for economic and personal reasons. I mean, couldn't we say the same thing about having access to high-speed internet service today, that it's absolutely needed? It's really not an option anymore?
Absolutely. That's exactly the right way to put it. You know, in the 30s, after the Depression, there was a decision that was made to get electricity to the most the farm at the end of the dirt road all across America. That was not an economic decision. It was a political, social decision, an acknowledgement that rural America had to be treated as a first-class citizen and not left behind. There wasn't an economic case for the utilities to be doing that, but what we had was governmental policy saying we're going to wire all of America. That same decision has to be made now. You know, you've got in the urban areas a profit model that works for the big carriers. It doesn't work for them economically to get the broadband to rural parts of Vermont, rural parts of America. And that's where the federal government has to play a role here, because we absolutely have to have that service available. And you've said it exactly, Bob. With social distancing and with telemedicine, if we don't have broadband, people can't work at home, kids can't study at home, and they can't get access to medicine at home when they need it. So this is absolutely essential for the well-being of Vermont and for the well-being of rural America. And if we're going to have an economic revival, it has to include access to the internet, because that is a prerequisite for any business in a rural area trying to be able to make a profit. So that's something, by the way, that is so true that it's not a red state, blue state divide on this. A lot of my Republican colleagues that are in the Rural Broadband Caucus with me represent very rural parts of the country. And what I just outlined is the challenges that we face in Vermont are the same challenges that they face. So I think we know that we have to have this, and I think that Congress has to address it and has to do it soon.
Congressman, we've got a bunch of people who wrote us on email who are, as you can probably understand, very frustrated. They live in rural parts of Vermont. They have terrible or no internet service. We heard from Aaron, who wrote us from Reading, saying we have no cable or wired broadband option out on our dirt road. Signing up for satellite-based service is really no better than using my phone hotspot. For those reasons, I find it incredibly frustrating that the internet is not treated like a public utility and made available to all homes through government agencies. And we also heard from Ben, who wrote us from Greensboro, who said, I've been told that fiber is available, just not where I live. When I get vague answers about when the federal minimum speed is going to be available, it is very frustrating. What would be helpful is making broadband the same as telephone or electrical service, and that providers have to be at the federal minimum speed. Currently, it seems that providers provide service to areas that are easy, ignoring the areas they deem challenging. So as you look at this issue and you talk to folks in the Rural Broadband Caucus in the U.S. House, what seems to be the best solution?
Well, first of all, I agree with that that description. That's exactly right. You know, the big carriers, I don't particularly care about the rural areas because they don't get the return. But on the other hand, we need the broadband just like we need electricity. And that's number one. Number two, we're finally starting to change what are the standards. What we're saying in the Rural Broadband Caucus is second-class standards do not work for rural America. We want to be wired here with high speed, the same as the urban areas, because if we're constantly getting a second-class system, we're always going to be behind as technology advances. So bottom line for us is we get the same service as is provided in the urban areas. The third thing is that there has to be a governmental role here with some funding and then some flexibility about how to deploy. We have some good local carriers here, but the economics don't work, and that's where there has to be federal funds that make that possible. And there are funds, even outside of this whole stimulus and recovery issue that we're talking about now because of the coronavirus. There's broadband spectrum that has been basically loaned to foreign satellite companies. And there are a group of us that have legislation that would take that back because it's not being used, sell it at auction, and that could raise about $50 billion that could be utilized for the deployment of broadband across America. So the caller is right. I hear this from Vermonters all of the time. You know, I've lived in rural parts of Vermont and started out with dial-up, but now we've got EC Fiber, which has done a fantastic job in certain towns in the Upper Valley, and we want to make sure that that level of service is available all across Vermont.
Do you think that the proposal or the model of the Rural Electrification Act back in the 1930s, which really created a lot of co-ops, if I understand it correctly, in rural parts of the state, does that serve as a model for what needs to be done for broadband?
It does. But there's two parts to that, okay? One is the co-op model, and that was where the people who were in that service territory were going to benefit and had some responsibility and engagement in getting the services deployed. But second, and this is really the heart of the challenge we face right now, there was a political decision made in Congress with the support of a lot of rural members of Congress that were saying, look, we want to get electricity just like they have in New York City or in Boston. And now we've got rural members of Congress like myself saying, hey, we want to have high-speed broadband, same standard as New York City or Boston, in Greensboro, in Walden. And that's the decision that has to be made, because if we make that decision, then the implementation flows from that.
How confident are you that that decision will be made?
I think it will. There's been a strong desire on the part of my Republican colleagues to do this. And on the Energy and Commerce Committee, where we have jurisdiction, we've got solid bipartisan support, including use of that spectrum auction to put money into it. And I think that it's only intensified as we've seen the absolute essential requirement that you have broadband in order to socially distance and to get through this COVID virus. You have to have it for business. You have to have it for homework. You have to have it for shopping. You have to have it for medicine. So the case about whether it is or isn't essential is obvious. So I think we'll get there. I mean, it's always hard to predict anything with immense confidence in Washington, but this is something that just cuts across a social class, political party lines, and is obviously really, really essential.
Let's go to our callers and talk to Irv, who's calling from Norwich. Hi, Irv. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. And hello, Peter. I have a quick comment. My quick comment is that the speed standards need to emphasize upload speed, which is essential for teleworking, for study from home, for telemedicine. And the 25.3 underrates the upload speed that's needed to do meaningful interaction from home.
You know, Irv, I know you're totally right on that, and that's what has been a battle that I've been engaged in D.C., and I think ultimately we've been successful in saying that we don't want a second-class standard for rural America. We want urban standards, and that's why the cable, the fiber is absolutely essential. So my view, and in the Rural Broadband Caucus, no second-class standard for rural America. It just isn't. It'll keep us in a subordinate state forever.
Irv, thanks for your phone call. Let's turn to Mark, who is calling from Johnson. Hey, Mark, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me on. My real concern is if we bring in this federal grant money and it ends up going to Comcast, who I happen to have been a customer of, I'm really concerned that this is just going to go to the bottom line of a for-profit business. And I hope that somehow this can be geared toward nonprofits, our CUDs, and our electric co-ops, and it won't just be fattening Comcast's bottom line.
Well, I agree with you on that. I think that these rural co-ops, as Bob was saying in the beginning, they're invested in meeting the needs of the people in their district, not necessarily bottom line shareholders. So the Comcast model simply doesn't work. And by the way, if Comcast were so great, why aren't they out there wiring to rural America? So I share your skepticism. But there's two parts to this if we're going to get it right. One is you do need some money in order to do the work to deploy the system. But number two, it's got to be done in a practical way where the orientation is the people who are in the service area as opposed to the executives who are looking to just increase their bottom line. So I think the co-op model or the EC fiber model that has worked so well in the territories it serves here in Vermont, those are solid examples. Thank you.
Mark, thanks for your phone call. Congressman, we got this email from Jonathan in Danville who wrote us, "The nature of many federal grant programs for broadband prioritize shovel-ready projects, which tend to favor larger incumbent providers. In practice, this means shoveling more money towards areas that already have decent broadband service. What can be done to make funding more equitable for community broadband projects like Vermont's Communications Union districts?"
To actually defer to local leadership and to that co-op type of model, I think makes a lot of sense. I mean, this is something that is really important that these callers are bringing up. It's one thing to have federal money, and we've got to have money to invest to build out the system. But just throwing money out the window and the hopes that it's going to stick does not work. And what I've seen in our Rural Broadband Caucus around the country is that you do have some local entities. Sometimes it's a municipality. Sometimes it's a nonprofit. I mentioned EC Fiber. That happens to be who serves us in my house. And they work, and they're efficient. And their business model is about serving the people in their territory as opposed to just building a gigantic corporation. So I think the challenge is going to be for us in Congress is, A, getting the resources, but, B, deploying the resources in a way where there's immense deference to local leadership, where the folks locally know better how best to do it and have as their goal serving the people in their territory.
Let's talk to Bill, who's also calling from Johnson. Hey, Bill, welcome to the program.
Oh, thank you. Representative Welch, known you since the Paul Poirier campaign days, sir. Thank you for addressing this subject. I have experience with a section of Route 100 that's 15 miles long that has absolutely zero cell phone coverage. And I would submit that that is a gap that has to be addressed first before broadband, for the simple reason that most everyday folks, A, they have a cell phone, B, they don't have a hard line, and they can do most of their normal internet activity. And even small businesses, my auto mechanic buys parts over his phone where he has service. But here's a 15-mile stretch of Route 100, one of the busiest sections of one of the biggest state highways, that has zero coverage. Will these initiatives of yours and some of the CARES Act money possibly be able to push for closing those gaps? Because there's no longer a market share fight between the cell providers to close those gaps.
Well, the focus is on broadband, and I mean, what you're citing is a problem. I know you're right. I've been on that 15-mile stretch myself, and all of us driving around Vermont deal with dropped calls. But the focus is on broadband right now, and that's where the energies are from the Rural Broadband Caucus and the Energy and Commerce Committee. So I can't say that the CARES money will necessarily go to fix that 15-mile gap. And I can say that I think the priority has been on getting the broadband everywhere, even though I agree with you that cell phone coverage ideally is going to be comprehensive and solid.
Congressman Welch, it's been interesting. In the last week or so, I've seen a fair amount of criticism from some of your progressive colleagues in the Democratic caucus who feel that the $2.2 trillion package that passed recently was geared too much to big business and not enough to individuals and small businesses. Do you share that criticism?
Well, the biggest criticism is that we're not able to meet all of the needs. I mean, the focus of the programs are, let's just go through them, because there are some problems that I think we've got to fix. Number one are the checks. 100 million have gone out. Folks who get paper checks are going to have to wait another month or two, and that's going to be really hard on them. But that was one. Second, on the unemployment, the $600 from the federal government I think has really been a lifesaver for a lot of people. And we had a big challenge in all of our states, and including Vermont, with the state unemployment offices having to gear up from, in the case of Vermont, 300 claims to 17,000. And the governor, as you know, has worked extremely hard to get that on board. So I think the unemployment, the checks, have been money in the pocket that has been essential, even though there have been some challenges with the deployment of it. The area where I have continuing concern is the payroll protection plan. And there is criticism, valid criticism, that some of these big chains like Ruth Chris Steakhouse, Shake Shack, they got in line first. They were connected with the big banks. And I object to that. And that was changed in the second round. But what we have to do now, and this is what I've been hearing from especially like the folks in the restaurant business and many other small businesses, the regulations under that were put together like in a week by the SBA. And they require that if you participate in that program as a small business, you basically have to use the money by June 15th to pay your payroll. That's too tight. Like our restaurants, even if they were able to open tomorrow, they wouldn't necessarily have people coming back in until they felt pretty comfortable. So the big suggestion I've had from our folks, our small businesses, is, Peter, let's get that date pushed back from like June 30th of several months. And yesterday, in conversation with the speaker and also the chair of the Small Business Committee, I explained that, as did some of my other colleagues. And we're going to be in the next package trying to push that back into the fall. That will give a lot of latitude for our small businesses who got in line to be able to take advantage of it. Otherwise, the regulations that aren't clear and the timing that's too short would hurt them. And Senator Leahy, Senator Sanders, and I sent a letter to the Treasury Secretary making advocating for these changes to make the program practical. And in Vermont, we haven't had that big problem that they've had in some of the urban areas. We've had the first round, 7,000 businesses were able to get access to $1 billion. And in this second round, we've had 4,000 businesses so far get access to $200 million. So we've got to make changes in this plan. We've got to do more. But that's not surprising to me, given that this $2.2 trillion package was passed in a week.
You know, Congressman, some dairy farmers in Vermont feel that they've been really neglected by Congress with all these different stimulus packages and the money that was available to small businesses. There was a $10,000 grant right off the bat. Then there was additional money, as you mentioned, through the payroll protection program. What do you say to farmers in the state who feel like, you know, Congress sure hasn't done a lot for us?
Well, they're right. I mean, it's very, very frustrating because the economic injury disaster loan, when we voted for that, all of us, certainly I did, believed that that $10,000 grant was going to be available to all our small businesses. And in the initial round, the SBA drew up guidance that was really contrary to my view of what I voted for, and it was really cutting dairy out of access to that. In the second round, they made dairy in other farms, the small farms, eligible for it, but they wrote the guidelines in a way where it would depend on how many employees our farms had, and they could get $1,000 per employee. So with that new guidance, some of our farms are going to be making those applications, but even there it's tough because, as you know, many of our farms have very few folks milking the cows. And there was an exclusion that was insisted by the Republican Senate that anybody working here on a farm on a visa, and that's like Mexican workers who are here legitimately with a Mexican visa, that farm would not be eligible to get that grant for that person who was employed there. So it's really been tough on the farmers, and that coincides with the collapse in the price of milk that is even worse for our farmers. And that price of milk has plunged because that market to schools, to restaurants, all of the milk that went there, and that was huge. There's no market for that, even though there is expanding sales of dairy in our grocery stores. But it's really tough on the farmers.
Would you expect that in the next stimulus package that I know members of Congress are starting to talk about, that there will be some provisions in that bill that will be more advantageous for dairy farmers?
Well, I hope so, and we're pushing for it. And the big challenge that we keep running into is that the farm economy is not just dairy, obviously. That's really critical for us here in cheese and vegetables. But all around the country, you're seeing real dislocation that is causing the prices to plunge. So, for instance, the inability to sell as much milk as we did before because there's no school market, there's no restaurant market. We've seen farmers dumping milk. Out in the Midwest, we're seeing some of the pork producers euthanize their hogs, and it's because they can't get it to market. And the real challenge for farmers and for many of our ag in the ag sector is the price of what they sell has plummeted. And the question that comes up when we start talking about basic price support is the cost of it when you spread it across all of the commodities in agriculture. So that has been the real challenge. And it's one of the reasons why in the past I've always been a supporter of supply management, where you try to keep that supply steady but not having it expand all of the time. So it's a real, real challenge for our farmers. But it's something that we have to keep fighting for, because on something like this, where it's really a virus that has just devastated our farms and their farm economy, if they all go out of business, what happens to us when we need to get milk and other agricultural products once this is behind us and the farms aren't there? So I am a strong supporter of doing everything we can to help them hold on. But our dairy farms in particular went into this in a pretty vulnerable state. And then we saw the price of their product in March just collapse. So that's the challenge we face.
Let's talk to Peter, who is calling from Brattleboro. Hey, Peter, welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks. I was going to urge the congressmen to consider voting for the H.R. 6515 bill, which would put a temporary moratorium on rents and mortgages. There are a lot of people out there who are living hand to mouth, and with them being put out of work, they have trouble making their rents, and the landlords in turn have trouble paying their mortgages. And I think it would also, if that was put in place, the moratorium on rents and mortgages, it would save the government some money.
Well, part of what we may do in the next package is create a fund that would essentially accomplish what you're suggesting. Because if people are completely out of their job and don't have any income, they're not going to be able to pay their rent or mortgage. But on the other hand, if you're a small landlord and you're depending on that rent in order to pay your mortgage, the whole cascade effect will just continue. So the discussion that I think makes sense is to have in the next CARES package a fund that in effect is with a lot of state involvement, where if there are situations where people can't pay their utility or they can't pay their rent, then there's got to be some demonstration of how factually of that, but that the fund would be utilized to cover the rent or the mortgage or the utility. Because what you're talking about it just cascades across, obviously, the entire economy. That's the way we could do this, where we're not penalizing, let's say, a small renter, but we're not having an expectation that a hardworking person who can't pay the rent is suddenly going to be thrown out.
Peter in Brattleboro, thanks very much for your phone call. It's a situation that is affecting a lot of people. Let's talk to Rob in Lincoln. Hey, Rob, welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks, Bob. Hi, Representative Welch. My question regarding that next CARES package is looking at sort of the loss of revenue in our education fund here in the state of Vermont. Is there any talk about trying to help K-12 public education school systems, not only in Vermont, but across the country? Thank you.
Yeah, the answer to that, Rob, is yes. And in fact, I think the heart of the next relief package will be aid to the states and localities. And this is going to be a debate because, as you may have seen or remember, Senator McConnell basically suggested that if the states are having problems with revenues, they should declare bankruptcy. And that's a pretty absurd, irresponsible statement, and I think he's even backing off from that. But just take Vermont. What I understand is that Vermont, just this fiscal year, which ends June 30, we're going to be down about $200 million in revenues, and that's even as our expenses have exploded. And next year, Vermont is looking at losing about $500 million in revenues, again, as expenses increase. So what happens if the federal government, which is really there to help in time of need, it's the only governmental entity that has the fiscal flexibility and capacity to help in an emergency, and that's absolutely what we're in. If we at the federal level don't help Vermont and other states, then what you're talking about comes to pass. There's brutal pressure on our property taxpayers. There's brutal pressure on our education system, and we can't give up on the absolute urgency of educating our kids. There's wicked pressure on our firefighters and police who are dependent on local and state revenues. So the next step here, I think, has to be that we include significant aid to our states to make up for all the coronavirus expenses. Thank you.
Congressman, are you thinking that the money will be appropriated to individual states and that each state on their own will determine the best way to spend that money?
Well, I favor that. I think that there should be flexibility. As long as states maintain their efforts and they don't use it, as some states in the past have done, to give tax cuts. But if you have a state that has these real challenges with, like, for instance, Vermont. Vermont makes a big contribution from Montpelier to our education fund. I think the state is the best entity to decide how best to deploy that money. And I'd like those decisions to be made by Governor Scott and by the General Assembly. So I favor money back to Vermont with considerable flexibility for Vermonters to make the decision on how best to meet their needs.
Let's turn to Jim, who's calling from Burlington. Hey, Jim, welcome to the program.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, thanks.
Congressman Welch, my question is,
Yes. Is
there, as far as the Payroll Protection Act is concerned, is there any requirement to show that your business was negatively affected by the coronavirus? I anecdotally know of a few businesses that have received a loan from the PPA, but who are still operating business. They're still having, you know, having income from their business. Their employees are still being paid. And so if it does become a forgivable loan, it basically amount to a paycheck for the owner of the company rather than going to a business whose doors have been shut, like a restaurant or something like that, due to
right.
coronavirus. So I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Thank you. You know, you are right. You've identified what is a real problem, potentially, of abuse, because there is a requirement that you assert, essentially, that you've been affected by the coronavirus, but it's very relaxed. And there's a big – and there's two problems that I've seen with the PPP. One, for the legitimate – for the businesses that have really been impacted, they've had to let their workers go. They have no customers coming in to the restaurant. They need flexibility. The timeline for them was way too short, and we're trying to get that pushed back into the end of the summer or late fall, and I think we're going to be successful on that because I've heard so many Vermonters. But then the other one, the one you just described, is a problem. If you have a business where they basically can work from home and they have the revenue coming in and they're continuing to do the same work after the social distancing that they were doing before, they're just doing it home instead of doing it in the office, but it's the same revenue. I don't think that's where the PPP should go. I agree with you. So that is something that we're going to look at too in this second round. But you're right about that. Thank you.
Congressman, we've had a number of people write us who are wondering, so far the federal government has spent something like $3 trillion on coronavirus programs. There's talk of another $3, $4, $5 trillion in additional stimulus packages. These folks want to know, how are we paying for this?
It's borrowed money. I mean, let me be candid. This is a big deal because what happened, this coronavirus, first of all, we haven't really talked about that yet. It's very, very serious. I mean, we've got over 3 million cases around the world. In 1.2 million cases in about 2 months in the country, 70,000 deaths. We've lost more lives than we did in the entire Vietnam War. This health scare is terrible, is really fierce. And this the spread of this disease is immense. So we had to do social distancing, and I think the governor here in our state has been providing very good leadership on that. But the consequence of social distancing necessary to protect our health and start suppressing the spread of the disease is you shut the economy down. And what do? And I think there's two approaches you can take. You can decide, you know what, we're going to have our federal government do whatever it takes, and we're going to err on the side of doing too much because we'll never be able to figure out exactly what's the right level to do. But we're going to err on doing all we can to help everyday people who are complying with what's required for public health. Or we can take the position we'll do too little. And if we do too little, the pain is going to be much longer and much sharper. So I'm on the side. I'll be very clear with Vermonters on this because I've been a pay-as-you-go person. And, you know, if we're going to spend money on this, let's get it from somewhere. Let's cut something out or let's raise the taxes. But on this, I am all in on saying we've got to do our level best to help Vermont fight another day, our businesses, our families, our healthcare system in our state. So, yes, it is borrowed money, but will we be able to be in a better position if we get the economy unlocked, we keep people healthy, we get them back to work, than if we hunker down and don't provide aid and we create the biggest depression in the history of the country? That's the decision that we have to make, and I'm on the side of erring on too much.
Congressman, we've been talking about a new stimulus package, and Senator McConnell has said that a key part of any new stimulus package has got to deal with liability of corporations and businesses. And we got this email from Elliot, who, looking at it from the point of view of the workers, if Congress approves another stimulus bill, what provisions will you put in place to protect workers in industries like meatpacking, retail, and other large service sectors to ensure that worker health and not release corporations from liabilities? It seems like Senator McConnell is taking the other point of view and has said there will be no additional stimulus money unless these corporations are released from liability. How do you see this issue?
Well, I think first we have to be concerned about the safety and well-being of all Americans and folks who are on the front lines and working. We want to be concerned about making as much as we can them working in a safe situation. You know, to some extent, there's two separate issues here. What McConnell is usually talking about is just a safe harbor for corporations. Whatever it is they want, he's fine giving it to them. And we saw that in the tax bill. I mean, he just gave away billions and billions of dollars to corporations that had record profits. So it's, in my view, honestly, it's kind of the typical thing that McConnell does. And I think all of us, Republicans and Democrats, have to be super concerned about the health and safety by really asserting the importance of these social distancing. And getting into the liability fight, there's some situations where we'll have to figure it out. The virus has an incredible life of its own, but we don't want to get into big litigation thinking that's going to solve on this. But I think what we should do is make certain that the standard provisions that apply to workplace safety are adhered to and maybe even enhanced for people who are on the front lines of this. So that's a fight, but it's not going to be resolved real easily with Senator McConnell.
Let's go back to our callers and talk to Matthew, who's calling from Burlington. Hey, Matthew, welcome to the program.
Hi, Bob. Thanks for taking my call. Listen, I have a couple of small businesses in the Chittenden County area. They're both bars, and obviously we are going to be the ones who we were the first to close, and we're certainly going to be the last to open. We don't provide food except for a cheese plate, which is something we need to do. And alcohol is where we make our money. So we did actually apply for the PPP loan, and we did receive it in the first round, which was, to start with, a godsend. We thought this is going to keep us afloat. We're going to be all right. The problem is the eight-week period. I appreciate the fact, Congressman, that you're going to expand that. Look, it's expanding that because that will help us. But right now, if it doesn't happen, I'm concerned, as a lot of other bar owners are concerned, that if we do try and bring staff back, which we are doing, we're not going to be forgiven because there's not enough information as to how the forgiveness is actually going to work. In fact, it's so convoluted that if you look at it, you could actually bring people back, come to find out that you're not going to get forgiven that money and end up having to pay more. And I wonder if you could tell us a little bit or have some information on how that forgiveness will actually work, because when I've spoken to SBA as well as my bank manager, they don't have any understanding exactly of what's going on.
Okay. Well, first of all, you're exactly the kind of business for whom the PPP program that we voted on was intended to help, okay? So we did that in a week. We authorized the money and we authorized the program. Second, you had the SBA on the fly writing up the regulations. And the regulations that they've written simply don't correspond to the intention that we had in passing that legislation, which was to make certain that operations like yours were helped. So what we're doing now is trying to adjust those to give you, A, some certainty and confidence that if you use it for the intended purpose, you'll be okay. So that's the goal, and I think we're going to make progress on the next bill by extending that period. I mean, if you had to do this within 8 weeks and you don't even if you opened, there's going to be a slow confidence level incremental that the public is going to feel safe coming back. So we've got to give you more time, and that's why I'd like to have it be at least till the end of the summer, but preferably till the end of the year. And then secondly, I think those of us in Congress who are for this, and that's pretty much all of us, and it's not a Republican-Democratic deal, you could be having a bar in Oklahoma. I mean, and the folk, your counterpart there is going to have the same challenges about the uncertainty and the time frame. So I have some confidence on that basis that we'll find the capacity in Congress, Republicans and Democrats, to give you the certainty ultimately that you need and be the time that you need in order for this to help you out. Because we need you. I mean, the restaurants and the bars, they add so much to kind of the quality of life here in Vermont. We're really proud of the folks, the microbreweries, the Jasper Hill cheeses, the restaurants that are so good. I mean, we've got to get you back in business.
Matthew, thanks for your question. Congressman, before we end today, we've had people ask us, what is Congress going to do to help rural hospitals? And we've been talking about federal aid to states, municipalities. We're seeing our hospitals just get hit incredibly hard. Governor Scott has decided to open up some elective surgery, see how that goes, see if it affects the transmission rate at all. But is there going to be some federal assistance for rural hospitals to help them stay open in the future?
There is, and there already has been. In fact, our hospitals have all received checks, and it's not enough, and more is going to come. But in the second CARES package, we had $100 billion, 75 of which went to hospitals. And in the first package, we had money that was also assigned to the hospitals. So the rural hospitals in particular are on the ropes. They all had to prepare for COVID as though they were going to be overwhelmed. They had to eliminate really elective surgery. And by the way, elective is too broad a word. It's not it's things oftentimes that you really need, but they don't have to be done right then, but they have to be done. So there's been an 18% reduction in revenue for our hospitals across the country as a result of ramping up for COVID. But the answer to the question, will there be money to the hospitals? The answer to that is yes, and there already is money, and they're receiving some, even though I can't say that that necessarily is going to make it smooth sailing for them. It's really a challenge.
Let's see if we can get a very quick call in from Bob in Norwich. Hey, Bob, welcome to the program.
Yeah, thank you very much for taking the call. My question relates to testing and contact tracing. Congressman, as you know, during World War II, the federal government created a war production board to mobilize American industry to build the planes and tanks and guns and ships for the war effort. It's pretty clear that getting the country back on its feet economically is going to be greatly delayed and could even be further hindered by second or third waves of the virus unless we have a massive testing and contact tracing program. Having each state design and carry out its own testing and tracing program, it doesn't seem to me is going to work because people travel in this country and the system will only be as strong as its weakest link. So my question is, why doesn't the Congress, by legislation, do what the Trump administration has failed to do by establishing a temporary agency modeled on the War Production Board with the task of organizing the country and administering a comprehensive testing and tracing and isolation program?
Well, you're exactly right. And that is why with Donna Shalala, who's a colleague now from Florida, and she used to be the Health and Human Services Secretary, and my colleague Jamie Raskin, we've introduced the Reopen America Act. And it specifically talks about the need for the federal government to take the lead, the War Production Board type lead, on testing, on contact tracing, and on quarantine. And we haven't talked about this in the program, but it's actually the most essential thing we can do in order to get our economy back. This has to be federal leadership. You can't have every state coming up with its own test. You can't have every state having to hire all of the people needed to do the contact tracing. But you have to – we know from pandemic history in the past what works, and testing works. Do the contact tracing where you're finding out if I tested positive who I was in contact with, and you test them, and then you have a means to quarantine. And that's what suppresses the spread. So you're exactly right. And the big gap in our leadership here is at the federal level, and it's at the administration level. I mean, we've got a president who wants this virus to go away, as we all do, but won't do anything about it. And it's at that federal level, the executive level, where you've got to just grab this by the throat and do the things that are necessary, the testing, the contact tracing, and the quarantining. So we in Congress, my colleagues and I, have embraced that, and we're going to attempt to legislate that. But bottom line, at a certain point, whatever we legislate, the executive has to do, and you need an executive who wants to plunge in and address on a day-to-day basis the grim realities that are out there that we've got to wrestle to the ground. And I haven't seen evidence that at the executive level in Washington that the president's up to that job. I have seen evidence that our governor is up to that job, and governors around the country, Republican and Democrat, are embracing that obligation.
Congressman Peter Welch, we really appreciate you taking the time today to talk to us about these very important issues and to answer questions from our listeners. Thanks again very much.
Thank you. Thank everybody.